We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. This is episode 28, Literary Takes on Harry Potter. Thanks for joining us at Potterversity. Today, Emily Strand and I will talk with Dr. Cecilia Conchar-Farr about her anthology, Open at the Close, Literary Essays on Harry Potter. I am Katie McDaniel, Professor of History at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds Too.
And I am Emily Strand, Instructor of Comparative Religions and Cultural Competence at Mount Carmel College, and author of several Harry Potter essays.
Today, we're going to be talking about the literary qualities of the Harry Potter books, which are so often overlooked in Potter scholarship. I think this is really something that we haven't delved enough into before the book that we're going to talk about today. And so we're having that discussion with our friend, Dr. Cecilia Conchar-Farr. She is professor of English and dean of the College of Liberal and Creative Arts at West Liberty State University in West Virginia. And she's the editor of the book we're discussing today, Open at the Close, Literary Essays on Harry Potter. Welcome to the show, Cecilia.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me.
So I thought since you have said that a lot of the idea for this book germinated at the Chestnut Hill College event, the Harry Potter Academic Conference, that we would start with our, with our discussion, a little friendly question that we throw out at the beginning, just talking about the Harry Potter Academic Conference, which is gearing up for its 11th year. We are submitting proposals right now, depending on when you're listening to it. Yeah. And so I thought I would just, ask the two of you, what are some of your favorite memories of the conference? What keeps you coming back to it, Emily?
Oh, I have so many. It's hard to narrow it down. The conference is really what helped me to go from somebody who loved to listen to Harry Potter analysis on podcasts and read Harry Potter analysis to somebody who started creating that as well, especially through the courses that I've taken through Signum University. And so I have so many of those kind of, just brain, mind-blowing, moments of revelation about the Potter books, and the Potter films, the whole Potter phenomenon. But, I have to say, I keep going back every year, not only for those experiences, but for the friendships that I've made with people who attend the conference regularly. And there's just a little group of us, and it's always kind of a group that changes and morphs a little bit, and we add a person and we lost a person or whatever, but we have this little core group that enjoys the conference together. And I just enjoy all that conversation so much and that really fellowship that goes along with the event. What about you, Katie?
Oh, yeah. No, I totally agree. I'm with you on all of that. And I definitely feel like I go back for the people and there are people who come just to listen to the papers every year. And what a cool group that is. I love that people will wear their house robes and costumes. Mm-hmm. It's like the best academic conference anywhere.
Right. There is. It's fun that it kind of rides the line between, the academic side and the fan side. And and we all are okay with being academics who are fans and fans who dabble in academics sometimes, so.
Yeah. And I totally agree with you. What I was going to say also is that I always hear things that make me think about the books differently. And how amazing is that? It speaks to the quality of the material that we're dealing with also. But I think, and the phenomenon, because of course, there are all kinds of other things, you know, the movies and the fandom that get talked about as well. And, you know, I feel like I'm always getting new insights. And what I especially liked about what you said, Emily, was the idea that you can go from, you know, sitting in the audience to mm-hmm. being at the podium yourself.
Absolutely.
And those ideas, they create a kind of fertility. I feel like I'm always getting ideas for things that I might do.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And it's also, I have to say, and Katie and I are part of that little group that goes around together. Katie, I always feel like it's our podcast, like harvesting time, you know, like where we go around nabbing people. And do you want to be on the podcast?
Yeah.
We loved your paper, you know. So it's kind of like really nice in that sense because
get their email.
Fills up our plate. Yeah. Grab that person.
Yeah, definitely. Cecilia, what about you?
You know, it's the richness of that community, absolutely, that drew me to it. Patrick and Karen, the two founders of the conference, invited mm-hmm. me to do a keynote one year. I can't remember which year it was now, but it was after I had published a book with my students about Harry Potter. And my Harry Potter world had been mostly this insular, the college where I was working and the students that I was working with. And I didn't have the academic connections yet. And from the beginning of my engagement with higher ed, I was a feminist critic, and I was always pushing back against the sort of stuffiness of academic conferences and conversations mm-hmm. that seemed so insular. And I'm telling you, I walked into that conference at Chestnut Hill, and not only did it have this magical Harry Potter vibe, which was very engaging, but it was also like I recognized this as the kind of conference I'd always been looking for. There were high school students there, there mm-hmm. were just straight up fans, and there were fans presenting their ideas along with these academics who had years of expertise that they brought to bear on the novels. And it was this just great range of conversations about these books. And at the heart of it was this real affection for the books, which you often mm-hmm. also miss in higher education conversations mm-hmm. about books when they get so technical. So it had this energy that I felt like I'd been looking for my entire career, a kind of academic conference that engaged the public and really cared about the books we were examining and had room for enthusiasm and whimsy. Right. Like, mm-hmm. What's the name of the guy who always comes dressed up as different characters? And he's
cross-dresses. Brent Satterley.
Oh, Brent Satterley. I just friended him so I could follow his just sort of bonkers way of interrelating with the world. It's so great. Yeah. So, and then there are just, you know, I showed up in my, you know, suit and ready with my presentation and PowerPoint. There's that sort of academic version. And then really, I think the most engaging thing are those high school students who show up in mm-hmm. their uniforms for their houses and mm-hmm. say really smart things and care so deeply about talking about literature. That was my experience. And then when I saw that, I thought somebody needs to gather these ideas mm-hmm. about literature. And that was where this book came from. I thought, okay, I'll be that somebody. I'll demonstrate the range of interactions we have with this book across all different literary approaches and that are all smart and interesting. It's not all just close reading. It's mm-hmm. all kinds of a variety of approaches.
Right? Yeah. You know, there was a kind of trend in literary criticism. I'm sure it's still there. That suggests that if you like what you're doing, then you can't be objective or something about it. You can't be critical if you, you know, are enjoying the things that you're reading. There's some sort of idea that you're not supposed to really be a fan of it, right?
You know, yeah, I'm 100% a literary critic. I mean, my study was literary theory. I'm way more interested in like relationships between texts and readers than I am in actual texts, but I became a professor because I loved reading from a very young age, and there were books that I loved, and there have been people who wrote about who were writing about this so beautifully when I was in grad school, like Jan Radway was writing about what romance novels do so well for their readers, and then just sort of taking seriously the enthusiasm that people had for books. So there was a strain of literary criticism always, as long as I've been involved, that took that seriously. But You're absolutely right that the training that I got to be a teacher as well as to be a scholar was to have an intellectual distance. And again, mm-hmm. because I was such a committed feminist theorist, I always resisted that. Mm-hmm. But yes, intellectual distance seemed to be the preferred mode and the one that was most respected. So if you showed too much enthusiasm, you were suspect.
Yeah. And you know what you're talking about at the conferences, in general terms, like it's very democratic, right? Little d democratic, mm-hmm. in the sense that, you know, everybody can have their, you know, chance at the podium. I mean, it is, your abstracts are selected, right? So there is that little element, but, mm-hmm. you know, but there's a wide range of ages and, you know, different qualifications and their fans as well as scholars. And it's very democratic. And that if you have a more democratic approach to literature, right, where everybody can potentially engage with it, mm-hmm. then you have room for those affections and for having a fan reaction to the literature that you're actually interested in delving into. I see those two things as really very much tied in a kind of egalitarian movement.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's, there are legitimate literary questions that lots of people who aren't literary critics ask of text.
Yeah. Like
I just listened to the Alchemy episode.
Oh yeah.
And I believe that the person you were talking to was a scientist. Was she a scientist?
She's a philosopher, but
philosopher,
she was a chemistry.
That's right.
She was a chemistry major.
Chemistry major
Science
and
background,
became a philosopher.
Yeah.
Right. And here she was breaking down some like serious connections to other texts and to history and culture. She was doing literary critical work, mm-hmm. And you all were on the show with her. And that wasn't an episode that was aimed at literary criticism, but lots of people do that. Everybody who reads a book does that work. They
right.
say, you know, mm-hmm. did I like this? Why did I like it? Did it work for me? No, it didn't. Why not? We do that work. And I think that making the process, the way that we talk about those things more democratic, that's pretty much been the work of my life as a professor.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a good aim. I just think we need a lot more of that. And we often end up talking about issues related to that concept with a lot of our guests, because a lot of them are doing it as like a little side thing. And I think you even mentioned that in your book, like a lot of us, we call ourselves Potter scholars, but we have this other side of our scholarship.
Bea and I talked about that, Beatrice Groves, when I took a study abroad group, a Harry Potter study abroad to London and Oxford and Edinburgh. Actually, we ended in Orlando, but I'm not supposed
awesome.
To say that because it doesn't sound academic enough.
Oh man.
But we spent a great day in Oxford at Oxford with Bea.
Cool.
And she was
cool.
talking about, you know, I said, you know, you work at Oxford and here you are writing about Harry Potter. And she said, yeah, I kind of have to, I've been doing it sort of on the side and making sure that I do medieval, I think is what she does.
Right.
Her scholarship. And she'd been more and more integrating Harry Potter as her work, because mm-hmm. and I started this way too. It was the work I was doing on the side with my students. And then all of a sudden I'm like, you know what? This is fascinating. I want to do more of this. Let's go. I'm a Potter scholar. So
yeah.
I think a lot of us start with it sort of like, well, I don't want to really say anything because they're just so popular and this can't be serious, but we are serious and it's mm-hmm. serious work mm-hmm. we're doing. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it engages more people, I think is a great thing. I just came from my first LeakyCon and had a bigger, a room more full of audience members than I ever have at an academic conference. Cause there mm-hmm. we often talk to three or four other people. Sometimes there are more people on the panel than there are in the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a super engaged audience. Now, why would we not want to talk about these books that people are dying to talk about? It's
right.
our job.
Right. Yeah. And so let's talk a little bit about the material, right, of the Harry Potter series, and what makes it worth taking seriously. When people ask you, like, how can you take this seriously? You know, isn't it just that, you know, it's popular, it's just children's literature, it's just mm-hmm. fantasy. What's your response to that?
You know, my first response is I take seriously anything that my students take seriously. And that's what brought me to it in the first place. If my students come into a literature class and they have observations and questions about something that's really important to them, I want to stop and listen and figure out what that's about, because we need to meet them where they are. That's mm-hmm. how we work as professors. I'm not just delivering, you know, information about the great books to them from my perch on a dais in front of them. You know, that's not how we do it. The best way for me to teach a literature class is to completely engage people in that experience of analyzing texts. And if there are texts that they want to analyze, I'm willing to listen and work with that. So I ended up teaching a lot of classes that surprised me because I came in as pretty much a high theorist and a modernist and all of these really important academic things. I get into the classroom and suddenly I am the one who's teaching lesbian lit and queer texts. And then I'm the one who's teaching Oprah's book club. And then it was Harry Potter. I mean, it just is an evolution of me sort of following the challenges that my students are throwing out. Plus they keep me up to date on music. And when I wear something like I was wearing acid washed way too long and they said, you need to do that. It's just that interaction is so valuable to me. Yeah. It's just, there's nothing better, I think, than the energy when you enter a university in the fall, when there are all these new students and then you see the students that you've had before, and you just get to engage with ideas with young people who are engaging the ideas with you. It's like when I say, when I take students to Paris to study modernism, I see Paris again for the first time over and over. Yeah. So that's how I got to Harry Potter, that pathway, by paying attention to students. And because that this generation, and it's not just the generation of students who grew up with this, it's another generation behind them. And I have to say, it's the parents who, I'm the parent who was reading with that generation.
Right.
And I see those parents when I go to Wizarding World, I see those parents being just as engaged as their children are. So it's across generations too, I want to say, but, it's because that has been, these texts have been so important. That's what makes them worth studying. My major focus when I talk about literature again is reception. In other words, I'm way more interested in the reader than any other aspect of studying literature. Readers are what fascinate me the most. I have almost no use for authors. I was very big with The Author is Dead, and we can come back to this topic because I hate when people close text down by saying the author meant this or the author did this. Man, you have no idea about that author, because now with that text in front of us, we say in literary criticism, it's an author function and we create it. They're not there anymore.
Right.
It's you in the text. And so, yeah, that helps me with the whole rolling thing, which we can get back to.
Yeah.
But yeah, so the fascination with readers, that's what makes it absolutely so important to be studying them. Even if you object to them on other grounds, you have to acknowledge, if you are intellectually engaged with literature, with literacy at this moment in history, you need to be engaged with these books.
Right. And people read them. People read them. And your book, The Ulysses Delusion, which is great, that was such a cool book, is very much about, you know, the need to read and study what people are actually reading and studying, like Oprah's book club, like Harry Potter novels.
And then share what language, what approaches we have that get them to a place where they have the tools of analysis for themselves. Like some of them will just have the feeling, oh, this book didn't work. But then they really benefit from some language about how or why it didn't. And critics really benefit from being able to understand what readers are liking and not liking. So asking different questions, like about engagement and absorption and the things that readers value, relatability, discussability, those should be legitimate topics for critics too. Yeah, it goes both ways.
So Cecilia, in the universe of Harry Potter anthologies, and we love Harry Potter anthologies on the show.
Oh, yes.
What is unique about Open at the Close? You've talked a little bit about that, but you know, what's your pitch for this particular anthology, and what are some of the things that people can anticipate seeing when they get this book?
You know, I think the most important thing that we keep saying is it's the first collection that is literature focused. Lots of people have talked about Harry Potter from lots of different perspectives. There are academic studies, academic anthologies. This one was purposefully focused on literary analysis. And so in it, you get all sorts of different ways of approaching the text, and all of them are, you know, I could make a list of approaches when I teach intro to lit secret what we want to be doing. And they're all here. They're sociological, historical, feminist, rhetorical, all of these approaches that you would see in a textbook about literary criticism, they are in this book because we had this variety of literary critics who came at the text in different ways. And so I think that's what's unique about it. It showcases the many ways that literary approaches allow us to talk about these texts.
Yeah, I agree. It's a really good example. So I teach our history capstone. And one of the things that I searched for a long time and then I did find was something that would show, here's an example of this kind of approach. You know, here's an example of what Marxist history looks like. Mm-hmm. Here's an example of, you know, what the empiricist model looks like. Here's what it looks like when people are doing it, because I want them to be able to figure, you know, if you pull a book off a shelf, I want you to be able to know, oh, this is a Marxist reading, right? When you first pull it off. And I do think that you can get a sense for, you know, this is how, and I love that there was a lot, there was post-colonial reading. Mm-hmm. There's mm-hmm. also, I love the animal studies thing. There was one that was trauma focused. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of things that I think are kind of newer literary approaches that I think people, it will really open people's eyes to, like, that's what that kind of literary criticism can look like. And I just think how amazing that the Harry Potter stories can be read from so many perspectives.
They are so rich. Mm-hmm. And this, I think I've said this in every, with every opportunity I've had to talk about Harry Potter, the big surprise for me was how rich these novels are. Like, I can keep coming back to them. I've been teaching them now since 2010, and it's not boring and it doesn't feel repetitive.
Right.
A lot of that is because of the different readers and the joyfulness they bring to it. And again, playfulness, whimsy, these things are so important, sort of come so naturally with teaching Harry Potter. But yeah, I think that the way that I set it up, the first half is sort of traditional close reading, not 100%, but it's sort of a literary analysis that people recognize from when they are in school. Mm-hmm. And the second half,
and that's the Horcruxes section, right? Or is mm-hmm. it the, okay? Mm-hmm.
And the Hallows section, the second part, puts the novels in different contexts. So again, yeah, animal rights, post-colonial, trauma studies, feminist studies, all of those are in the second half. They're sort of contextual. They put the Harry Potter novels in a different context, and then they have things to say about the world, which is absolutely, we all know in our experience with Harry Potter that the people who read them enter the world differently. Often they want mm-hmm. it to be a more just and peaceful place. They want mm-hmm. it to be more diverse and generous. And I think these books, it's also we have to be very careful about saying this, because we don't want to make giant claims for books, but I think most of us who study literature think that literature can change the world. These books can make a difference.
Absolutely.
And I think the way that second set of essays, the second half of the book are written, you get the sense that these writers think that these books can affect the world in a positive way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Patrick McCauley's essay, I think, really starts that off. Reading Harry with the Risk of Trust and a Hopeful Search for Meaning. It's kind of a personal essay about him teaching and mm-hmm. the Harry Potter books in the classroom. And I just found that one to be very emotionally satisfying as a read. But I also wanted to bring up the animal rights one that I thought was so interesting. That's Carrie Diana Shez. Mm-hmm. Sorry, Not Sorry, The Limits of Empathy for Non-Human Creatures. And I'll tell you the example that she uses that really stood out for me. It was the denoming.
Oh,
right.
Yeah.
How they're like whirling the gnomes around. Right. And to get the gnomes out of the garden. But these gnomes seem like they're kind of sentient. So should that be happening? Is that cruelty? Like, I thought that was one of those examples of something that, like, it made me think about things in a totally different way.
Yes. In fact, Shez and Lopez in the essay right after that end up being pretty critical of where Harry is. Maybe he's not such a great example of generosity toward other species.
Tell us, though, Seal, the essay that you co-authored, Ascendio, A Close and Distant Reading of Progressive Complexity in the Harry Potter Series, tell us what you discovered in that essay co-authored with Amy Mars about the increasing complexity of the Harry Potter series.
You know, I had so much fun writing that essay because it just started out as a conversation between Amy, research librarian who specializes in the humanities at St. Catherine University in St. Paul, where I used to be. We just started talking about this. Isn't it great the way these books develop? They move with the age of the young people that are the stars of the books. Mm-hmm. So the first book is really suitable for an 11-year-old or younger, but by the time you get to the seventh, when they're 17, there's a whole different tone. And she was saying, and she has experience with children's literature, how unusual that is in any book series, but particularly in a children's book series, which usually has its audience aim and they shoot for, this is for 12 to 14 year olds, or this is for 7 to 10 year olds, right? And then the whole series will stay in that place and the author gets skilled at approaching that audience level. And so we were both sort of impressed at the way they seem to increase in complexity as they went along. And then
yeah, I mean, I think, Cecilia, if I could just break in, I think that a lot of people, like, intuitively, they see that. I mean, all you have to do is look at look at book five and the size of the words on the page, and you could see something has happened, right? And what I love about your essay is that you all did digital humanities. You actually, like, drilled down to see what is this complexity? What does it look like?
And that's what Amy could bring to it. And she really did such a great job. And I have to say, I really think the book, as it was published, Open at the Close, is lovely. But the online version, the digital version, her illustrations, her ways of demonstrating, her charts and graphs and all of that are in color and they're beautiful. She used different shades and colors to demonstrate, for example, the use of the word death and how it increases across all seven series. And those are in there in grayscale, but they're beautiful in color. So if you get a chance to look at it in the online version. So when Amy and I started wondering if that were actually true, if it's like provably true, then we went after it from two different directions. And I said, let's do the analysis of the plot and the characters and themes. And she was going to do the digital analysis, and we brought it together, and we expected it would just be pretty much a straight, you know, little uphill climb from the first to the seventh book. And it isn't actually, it's sort of in different versions. It peaks in the fifth book, which I think is very interesting that's the one you would point out. It's big. And it seems to be a real shift, but they get bigger. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. There's a progressive length, you know, gets longer. The chapters get longer, the characters get more complex, the themes get more serious. And then so 5, 6, and 7, we ended up thinking of them as more of a plateau, except the seventh book really does get more philosophical. There are questions being asked there. I mean, I could spend a year just in that King's Cross Station chapter at the end of book 7. In fact, I spent a 3-hour class in Edinburgh with a bunch of students once, and that's all we talked about was King's Cross Station. Wow. There's a lot in there that wasn't in the first book. So
yeah. And I love how you can see it in the charts, you know, this trajectory that you're mapping out, and that it's not so obvious as they're all changing in these predictable ways, always on a more complex trajectory, but that there are some different things that become more complicated toward the end. The fifth book is more complicated in some ways, or more sophisticated. I think maybe it was like language use and that kind of thing. But as you say, the seventh book is more philosophically challenging, which shows again, it's aiming for a more mature type of reader, somebody who's ready for those kinds of questions.
And that was the fun thing for Amy and me, is that we were wondering how digital humanities could be in conversation with more traditional approaches in the humanities. And so we started that conversation and then pursued it. It was really about 5 years that we talked about it and took notes and then wrote it up. Just fascinated that digital humanities could add those really nice shadings to our understanding of the complexity of those texts, but that without the conversation with the traditional humanities analysis, it would have made some maybe false conclusions or not so reliable conclusions. Mm-hmm. It was the conversation that made that essay for us, that both ways of approaching it gave us a better answer than either way alone would have.
Yeah, no, I think that's really important. I think, you know, as always, whenever you get some newfangled technology or whatever, people just want it to dominate.
Yeah.
And it's better to use it in context with what you already have, make it useful to what you're doing and you're interested in. And then it can, you know, it can be very helpful, useful, which show you new things.
Yeah, basically is the lesson we all learned about online learning during COVID.
Right.
We don't want to go all out that way, but we do see that there's some real value there. And yeah, we'll integrate
also,
it.
Also work with librarians. Yes, uh-huh. Yes. Always good. Work
absolutely.
With them.
Absolutely. 100%.
Yeah. So now, Emily, you actually have an essay in the volume. So tell us, what did you think about the pros of the Harry Potter novels and why, in the end, it doesn't matter?
Well, you know, what's funny is it seems as if the Harry Potter books, and, you know, you might even say this about all of the author's books, they're really aimed at whoever's ready for a great story, you know? And they're not aimed at someone who's picked up the book out of disgust for the popular, you know, swells around them, and who's ready to be dismissive of them, you know, because all popular things, you know, must be very, you know, inane. So it's funny because the topic, which was a Chestnut Hill talk that I gave, and it was really born out of my own, at the time, recent forays into fiction writing, which I had not done since I was literally a girl. And I just kind of got this whim and started writing this novel. And I joined a local writers group here in Columbus, and these people were just so helpful, you know, with my own writing, which I committed all of these very cardinal sins, you know, from the very start of trying to write a novel. And they, you know, they very patiently pointed out all my errors. And then when I was just kind of happened to be also reading Harry Potter to my son at the same time, for the first time, and I hadn't read them in a while. And, you know, as I'm reading, I'm seeing that she is also committing these errors, which I'm being told by people, you just can't do this. You can't do this. You know, you can't do this. And
give us an example, Emily. I'm sure there are fiction writers out there who want to know what's the sin.
Sure. Yeah. So she starts her book, the very first book, she's in Vernon Dursley's point of view, which doesn't hold, you know, it only holds for that chapter. And she starts out and she's talking about his day and how he's picking out a boring tie, you know, and it's funny and it's kind of like, you know, weird, and you pit the strange versus the normal, you know, and it's kind of this interesting juxtaposition. But she also dumps a whole bunch of information in that chapter, backstory that you need to know going forward. But it hampers the pace of the chapter so that you have paragraph after paragraph of this long backstory about, you know, Mr. Dursley's very un-Dursley-ish, you know, in-laws, Harry's parents, and how they were weirdos. And, you know, it's all this stuff from his point of view. And it just like kind of, you're like, hey, what's going on? What's happening here? This guy's just walking to work. Like, am I supposed to
Emily,
care about
I
this
think
book?
I told you, like my son, my older son, he couldn't get into the Harry Potter books the first time when he was like, I don't know, seven or something. I opened up the first book. I was like, I'm sharing with you one of my very favorites, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. And I started reading. We got about a page in and he was like,
boring.
Can we stop now?
Yeah.
Because this is boring. And the only way I got him to read it was I got him the Jim Kay Illustrated first one. Actually, I shouldn't say I got it for him. I got it for myself. And then I was like, I bet he would like this. And I turned it to the page where Hagrid says, Harry, you're a wizard, right? And then I was like, start here.
Right. Yeah. Skip to there.
Yeah.
Skip
and then, to there. And then he just devoured the whole series.
Right.
And then went back and read the beginning stuff. But that beginning is, it's just not, it's not so great for every reader.
And yet it's the most important 5 pages of your entire book, you know, because in terms of hooking a reader, and making sure that the reader is interested and invested in the story, you've got to hook them in somehow. And that's, you know, everybody, all of the writing manuals say that's not how to do it, is to put, you know, make a big information dump. Also her point of view inconsistencies, which, you know, if you take a step back and look at the whole series and take a look at the places where she pulls out of Harry's limited third person omniscient point of view, they're very significant, and they're doing some very specific work that she has to do. And it's almost like the filmic equivalent or the book equivalent of when a film starts from a very wide angle and kind of swoops in toward a particular point of view and then takes you with that, you know, then you kind of see the context before you get into the point of view, and it's very effective. But if you're just looking, if you just came from your prose, your fiction writing course or your fiction writing group like I did, and you're just looking at this and going, she's doing that wrong, she's doing this wrong, this is inconsistent, this is a mistake, you know, it's very, you know, so if you're ready to criticize the writing, you'll find lots to criticize. You know, another thing, and I called the essay, said Hermione earnestly, because she is really, and this is something that actually still annoys me with her writing whenever I read her writing. This is the only thing that annoys me, is she uses what we call said bookisms. And that is
a lot of adverbs.
Adverbs, right, to tell you how a person just said something. And it's, you know, so often it's Hermione saying things earnestly because, you know, that's how Hermione rolls. But, you know, we don't need to know that because we can tell from the scene. And she's such a great dialogue writer. We can tell from the characters' interactions and, you know, even how Hermione's hair is puffing up bigger or whatever. I don't know how she does it, but she is able to convey to us in these really much more convincing ways how the characters are speaking. And she doesn't need these adverbs, but she drops them in all over the place anyway, you know. But if you're reading to look for those little errors or those bad habits, and, you know, pick at them because these books are so popular, you know, then you'll find them. But if you're reading for a good story, you'll get that, you know. And the way that she writes in many ways mimics people like Jane Austen, which is a pretty good person to mimic, you know, in terms of telling a good story.
And Bea Groves has an essay about Jane Austen in there too,
right,
which is
right.
Awesome.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in fact, it was her work that led me to, you know, seeing Rowling's style, prose style, in that way as well. Mm-hmm. So there's just so much to celebrate. But in the end, she's just great at telling a good story in so many different ways. And for those people who are ready for that, the prose will read like a dream.
It doesn't clunk for you if you are so busy turning the page. It just doesn't. Yeah.
Right.
And I come from journalism and modernism, where, I mean, my favorite short story ever is this Hills Like White Elephants by Hemingway, which is almost completely in dialogue.
Oh my gosh.
And he never tells you who's talking, and he doesn't give you any context or background, but you pick it all up, the tension, the complexity, you pick it all up through the dialogue because he trusts you to do that. And
right.
He trusts himself as a writer that he's delivered that. So yeah, those parts of Rowling's writing do sort of land with a clunk if you're a critic and a writer, and that's what you've been trained to admire, and we have been trained to admire that. So yeah, absolutely. I had the same response, but by the time I got to book three, I didn't care at all anymore.
Right.
But I love those Dementors, the Marauders. I mean, and you know, that carried me through the rest of the series. Was just, what an incredible imagination, how deeply engaging.
And she's so able to communicate it through writing, right? You don't need the films to know what the Gryffindor common room looks like. We all
looks
like just from the books, you know.
Right.
Well, and that's where the films are really an interesting conversation, because they're not, I mean, I didn't see these things. I mean, Ron really looks nothing like film Ron. Is just, we all know, completely different from book Ron. And and Quidditch, so much more exciting when you're doing it in your head.
I don't know, I kind of like Quidditch on film. maybe not in the first couple movies, but
it does get better.
It does get better.
But Emily, your essay made me laugh out loud. There was a lot of good stuff in there with Harold Bloom and the
it was fun. That was the most fun part, I think, about writing it. I thought it would be a real, you know, gut clencher to read all these negative reviews of Harry Potter by these, you know, highfalutin sort of literary critics and stuff like that. But it ended up to just be hilarious, because they're so angry about these books and all the rules they break, you know. And it's just, you know, it's more of that, you know, Seal, what you were talking about at the beginning, you know, this sort of stranglehold that this kind of, if I can say, a white European descended, you know, approach to literary
patriarchal criticism.
Yeah, exactly. Because this had a stranglehold on other aspects of our culture as well. I mean, my area is really worship, and it's definitely had a stranglehold on the way that Christians especially worship. You know, the emphasis on a distanced approach, a very intellectual approach, where you don't become emotionally or physically engaged in worship. You know,
the formality. I mean,
the formality, right? Exactly. It can't be entertaining in any sense. You know, if you enjoy it too much, it was bad. You know, it's like it just doesn't make any sense.
And you know, to distrust that. Like for me, the pinnacle for this was at the end of the 20th century, everybody was doing a list of the greatest novels of the 20th century, and the Modern Library did one, and, you know, highly respected, lots of academics on the board choosing what are the most important novels of the 20th century, not a single Toni Morrison novel. And because Toni Morrison was doing social commentary, and that made her not aesthetic. Really? And anyone who, I don't know, how could you even imagine that Toni Morrison isn't one of the most important writers of the 20th century and arguably the most important? Yeah. And she wasn't even on there. And it is because, I mean, you have to realize that those qualities we learn to look for do reinforce a certain view of literature. Mm-hmm. They do, and they purposefully were made to celebrate certain kinds of texts by certain kinds of people.
Right.
And we do have to push back on that, because literature has to be engaged with the communities that it exists with. Mm-hmm. And those communities, they aren't just the young white men who go to college on the East Coast. That's not who books are for.
Right.
Thankfully.
Yeah, thankfully. Well, I have to say, there are a lot of gems in this book I have been particularly looking for, because at that same conference that I presented my presentation on Harry Potter's prose, but I know I so enjoyed Christina Philip Mattson's talk on nonsense, the legacy, her essay in here is called Say the Magic Word, Spell Work and the Legacy of Nonsense. So I remember being just really struck by that, and I'm so excited to have that in my hand so I can reference it. I would say the same thing of Lauren Camachi's essay, The Face of Evil, Physiognomy in Potter. That is a talk that totally blew my mind. So those are some of the highlights for me. But Seal, what do you think are some of the highlights that our listeners should particularly pay attention to in the book?
Well, you know, I found the quality, the voice of your essay, Emily, very, very much like the voice of Patrick's, where it was personal, but also so deeply thoughtful, that it was so clear that these texts engaged you on all different levels, but the tone that you brought to it, very much like the tone that Patrick brought to it, is just like your really smart friend thinking about these challenges out loud and you get to listen.
Right.
It's not like some distanced, oh, I need to really find time, or I could sit down and really concentrate on this, but it is really, they're both so thoughtful. They both have really great things to say, but they're said in such an engaging way because your voice is there. So that was one of the highlights for me, that we managed to in a lot of the essays have that personal relationship with the texts while still being analytical.
And we've got to tell people that there's a great McGonagall essay in here by Kate Glassman.
You know, that one, I love that one, because Kate Glassman was part of that team of editors that worked with me on the book that we called
anthology.
A Wizard of Their Age. Yes, that was critical essays from the Harry Potter generation. So it was all essays written by students from, I think it was 17 to 24 years old. And she had an essay in that collection and was one of the editors. And we had been having, she co-taught one of those study abroads with me. And we'd been having that conversation about how clearly amazing McGonagall is, how underanalyzed she is.
Yeah.
And so Kate did a really terrific feminist analysis.
The idea that there haven't been a lot of studies of McGonagall. It's just like, yeah, she's a badass. And then we don't pursue that. But I think we should. I think we should delve into how the many ways she is phenomenal.
Well, and every time people talk about Harry being parented, like missing the parents that he wanted to have, you mostly talk about, you know, Hagrid and Sirius and Dumbledore. And she's like, what about Molly? And what about Yeah. What about McGonagall, who, and I was going to say, I had this really great experience with that essay. I was talking to two of my nephews who are great nephews, actually, who were, I think, about 12 years old at the time. And I was saying, yeah, there's this really great essay in this book that I'm working on where they talk about the only time Harry ever used an unforgivable curse successfully is when someone in the seventh book, when
the Karos.
Karos, yeah, mm-hmm. Insults her, and he mm-hmm. appears like, "How dare you say that about McGonagall?"
Yeah.
And Crucianus is this guy. And then my little nephew said, "Well, what about the time just before that when he was using the Imperius curse in the bank?" So it's not the only time that he successfully used it, but it was right.
But it was very satisfying.
Yes,
it's like as a reader, you're like, I'm enjoying him using the unforgivable curse.
I know, and it's not even, it's not really necessary. You know, like the Imperius curse in the bank was probably a lot more necessary.
Yeah.
He was just really emotionally reacting.
Just, do not talk about McGonagall like that. Right. But I also just loved that my facts were corrected by two very young readers who said, I just read this, mm-hmm. I know. And they did know. I was also very happy to have people who have written about Harry Potter in other venues in this text, like John, who's written so much about Harry mm-hmm. Potter, has mm-hmm. a really good essay on Russian formalism.
Right, John Granger.
His analysis is, and B, who has a whole book on literary allusions in Harry Potter. So across the board, there were just like there was engagement from the people at the conference. And I just really appreciated that as I look down through this list of contributors that I like you, Emily, I remember hearing those talks and I hear their voices and I know those people. And mm-hmm. that makes for a really compelling collection for me that I feel like I managed to get some of the best work that's been done on Harry Potter from this perspective, from people who've been doing the work for a long time right here in this book. So,
yeah. And Tawanda Henderson also has been, you know, very connected in with the conference and its organization. And Tawanda wrote the essay on trauma. And that one was also like, it made me think about so many scenes just very differently, their reading of that. And then also this leads me kind of to my last question, because Tawanda offers a bit of a coda about some of the issues with writing about J.K. Rowling now, since she has made these troubling statements about trans people. And you were putting this book together as all that controversy was being stirred up and was brewing. How did you deal with that in the anthology?
You know, it was so great to have Tawanda to have conversations with at that point in Harry Potter studies, because Tawanda identifies as non-binary and trans, and they were struggling with their relationship with these texts. And since then, I think it would be okay to say that Tawanda has decided not to engage with the texts anymore, that they had to step away because Rowling was doing too much damage to people that Tawanda cared about. Clearly, Rowling did not value. And that was a game changer for Tawanda, because we were also working on another project, which Tawanda decided to not engage with. And I really respect that decision. But it was from our conversation that this coda came about. Tawanda rewrote their essay to not use J.K. Rowling's name.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I asked Tawanda, could you please reflect on that in a coda? And we decided that that would be the best way to end the book. Mm-hmm. To say, this is a big challenge for us now in Harry Potter studies. Here's one way that someone from the trans community is engaging this issue and sort of opening it up to all the different ways that we might come into conversation with these texts while still having respect for the people that we care deeply about, who Rowling is dismissing. And I mean, every time I tried to write about it, I would say sort of there's a suggestion of bigotry here. And Tawanda would say, no, that is bigotry.
Mm-hmm.
This is anti-trans. use the right words. And that was so helpful for me. Mm-hmm. And I'm so glad that Tolanda engaged in that conversation and that their piece is here, the last word in this text. Mm-hmm. I think it's really important.
Yeah. And I mean, I think there are a number of Potter scholars who are similarly doing what we were talking about earlier in terms of like the death of the author and all of that, who are trying to be more text focused and are not talking so much about J.K. Rowling, but are trying to talk more about the text itself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Most of us, I think, are trying not to mention her name at all. Mm-hmm. And I just came from my first LeakyCon and I posted a couple of pictures on my Instagram and I got notes from former students that said, you know, she makes money every time you go to Wizarding World. And one of the suggestions from some of the activist organizations who say, here are ways to stay engaged with the fans have come up with ways to stay engaged with the books without mm-hmm. benefiting Rowling. Mm-hmm. And not going to Universal, to Wizarding World is one of the ways they suggest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so the students said, I saw you posted pictures that you were there. And I have to say, I love that experience because it's like walking through an imaginary space that was only in books. And it's, you're immersed in it in a different way than you are in the movies. It's fascinating to me the way the texts are translated into a space that people visit and, mm-hmm. and interact with. So, but it probably wouldn't break my heart never to go there again. And I'm very serious about listening to how readers have decided mm-hmm. we should deal with these issues. And,
and
the advantage of having Tolanda thinking about that is that they're a PhD student in children's lit right now. They've been thinking about these issues for years. Mm-hmm. Such a well-informed opinion and so helpful to have Tolanda be part of that conversation.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think also it is important to let people have their own way of responding so that we're not telling people how they're allowed to participate with the things that they love and that have been meaningful to them in their lives related mm-hmm. to Harry Potter. And I'll just say J.K. Rowling doesn't need anybody's money. And so she doesn't need any of that. And she does donate a lot of that to charities that I think are generally pretty good. I mean, I think people are sometimes they're concerned about, you know, where is the money going to in certain charities, but I think all that stuff is good to be aware of and pay attention to. And then mm-hmm. we should all be doing what we think is the way we're going to, you know, to approach this world that we enjoy in a way that hopefully is not doing damage and might also, you know, be affirming to people who, and so many people who are trans, non-binary, you know, questioning all kinds of things have just found that to be such a wonderful realm for them. And that's part of why it was such a you know, brutal slap in the face, the things that she was saying, mm-hmm. I think.
Mm-hmm. It's also part of analyzing literature. I mean, those of us involved in Harry Potter studies absolutely need to be having the conversation about how we engage when we have a problematic author. And that's why Tyson Pugh is who I presented with at LeakyCon. And he's a queer scholar. He does queer theory. He's a gay man. And he and I have both, and me as a really deeply committed feminist, we continue to teach Harry Potter. And we were asking one another why we do and if we should. And mm-hmm. then we thought staging that conversation would be really important. Like, we need mm-hmm. the people who have been doing this work, we need to engage with that question and engage with it publicly. That's our responsibility as mm-hmm. As scholars in the world. So I'm really glad that a lot of us are having that conversation. I know that it's characterized by a lot of people as cancel culture. That is not what I see from the fans or the scholars. Mm-hmm. It's a real wrangling with what this means.
Right.
And if you're a literary scholar, you know that every person who's ever written is problematic in some way. They're all human. And, and Tyson's example is Chaucer, who may have raped someone. And when a student found that out, she was in Tyson's class and she said, I don't want to read the writings of a rapist. And it's like, Chaucer is a little bit more than that. And in fact, Hemingway is more than his incredible misogyny. Mm-hmm. The sentences I was talking about in that short story are amazing, and they've affected the way we think about literature. There are things that authors contribute, and they, you know, there are a lot of really, Milton was a horrible person, you know? There are really challenging writers in our history of literature. I know.
And yet influential, right? Yeah,
absolutely.
Ignore them.
And I don't want to sound dismissive of how hurtful some of the things Rowling said are, but she is a feminist, and this is a disagreement about what it mm-hmm. means to be a woman that we're talking about.
Right.
It's not that she, say, married her stepdaughter and
which one was that? Was that Milton?
It was a Poe. No, Poe married his cousin who's like 13.
Actually, yeah. I was actually talking about Woody Allen, but there are also
of course. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And but there are many, many artists who, you know, who's the director who can't come to the United States because he rapes people?
Oh yeah, Polanski, right?
Yes, exactly. Oh, so yeah. I'm just saying, on the scale of horrible things that artists have done, a disagreement about what it means to be a woman, a very public disagreement that is actually very hurtful to a lot of people, has to be put on a scale of egregiousness also.
Yeah. So, and also I don't mean to laugh about, you know, some of those things that are, you know, so terrible in people's backgrounds. But I think your point here that, you know, everyone is flawed. And a lot of writers are very, very flawed human beings.
Mm-hmm. Artists in general.
Right.
And their texts end up being so much better than they are. So much better, which is the magic of creating literature. I mean, these books are better than Rowling as a human. They just are.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I mean, that's really, I think as somebody who has written music and, you know, written some fiction and I hope my work is bigger than me. I hope it's better than me, you know?
Yep.
But that is a difficult concept for some people, especially when we're so, you know, we're so into the person and holding these people up as icons, you know?
Mm-hmm. That's nobody, the problem with celebrity, right?
Oh my gosh. Well, I was just talking to somebody about, you know, somebody had just watched the new Top Gun movie and was talking about, you know, singing the praises of Tom Cruise and saying everybody on set thought Tom Cruise was so great and everything. And I was like, pulling out my Scientology knowledge and going, oh, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know if I can, like, he's probably the reason I don't go see that movie, you know, but that's my reaction. That's not somebody else's reaction. I could still go see the movie and enjoy the movie. I don't have to enjoy Tom Cruise to enjoy Tom Cruise's work in that film, you know?
Yeah.
And so
but don't have to judge the people who enjoy the movie. Like I walked out of the first Top Gun the minute they took the camera, the PhD woman who's coming in to teach them about flying, and they start the camera at her feet and slowly work it up her body.
I know exactly what you're
talking
about.
She is only a body, and I was getting my master's and studying feminist theory, and I'm like, I'm done with this movie. I literally walked out. So
it's awesome.
But you know, my spouse loves the action movies, and I invite him to go see this new movie. I'm not going to, but you make choices about about
and they're choices that are right for you, you know, and that's important.
And that's why, again, the relationship between reader and text is so fascinating to me. I don't even really, how I relate to Rowling is completely insignificant to how I study these texts. It's so much more about the readers and the text themselves. Even the texts themselves are less important because I don't do those close readings and say, you know, well, I found this really great allusion to this thing. I don't usually do that either. But other people have different ways of reading where Rowling was much more central. And so their relationship is more fraught than mine.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, no, I get that. We've had, by the way, both Talanda and Tyson have been guests on the show, and wonderful guests, lots of really interesting things to say, and just very thoughtful, both of them. And of course, they both have they've had different trajectories on this issue. And I think also our responses can always be evolving. So
Let me take this back to the beginning where we were talking about the great community from Chestnut Hill, because I met Tyson by way of him being on your podcast.
Oh, fabulous.
Talanda and I knew to work together from the ways that we related, from not just being at Chestnut Sunt Hill, but also on your podcast, which creates community in a very similar way. And I really appreciate that you have a popular academic way of approaching the text.
Oh, cool. Yeah, that's what Thanks. We like too. And we hope that it's, you know, we want to make community, but we also want it to be open. Right. So we don't want to be cliquish or, you know, and that's one of the reasons why listeners, please send us your thoughts.
Yeah.
You know, we love to include all of what, you know, what people are listening to, and we like to have a good variety of guests. So,
and your ideas for episodes as well. Love to hear ideas.
Yes. Oh, for sure. Right.
Can I mention two more things about the book that we can't sign off without mentioning? So the first one, Seal, is just this cover is so gorgeous.
Yeah, it's a beautiful
Isn't
book.
It nice? That's University of Mississippi. They did a great job.
Good for them. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm holding it up to people going, this is what an academic book can look like, not just a weird font on like a marble-ish background. Like, So it's really, really engaging from the very cover. The second thing I want to mention is that MuggleNet, our parent organization here at Potterversity, they just posted a really great review of Open at the Close, penned by our own producer, Lori Beckoff. And so if listeners want to have a little review to read of the book that's very positive, you can find that at MuggleNet.
But let me tell you, Lori is critical. So her being positive, she's not just blowing smoke. So she'll give you all the dish, you know, but you know, you can take, that's a huge compliment. Get a great review from Lori Beckoff.
Yeah,
Thank you. That's great.
Yeah. Well, everyone, you will want a copy of this provocative, fascinating anthology. It's filled with interesting approaches that you may not have considered, and as we've suggested, might just change the way you think about some of the, even your most favorite episodes of the Harry Potter novels. Well, thank you so much, Cecilia, for joining us on the show today.
Thank you for having me. This was always, it's so fun to talk to you too.
I thought we would close today with some ruminations from Rufus Scrimgeour, of all people, on the most famous of all snitches, the one that indeed opened at the close. He said, "A snitch is not touched by bare skin before it is released, not even by the maker who wears gloves. It carries an enchantment by which it can identify the first human to lay hands upon it in the case of disputed capture. This snitch will remember your touch, Potter. It occurs to me that Dumbledore, who had prodigious magical skill, whatever his other faults, might have enchanted this snitch so that it will open only for you." Remember, listeners, that the Harry Potter books will always open just for you.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes, and be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Elsburn, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsburn. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Until next time, class dismissed.